ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। Let's chant the Mangala Shlokam together. Om Vasudevendra Yogindram Natva Jnana Pradam Gurum Mumukshunam Hitarthaya Tattva Bodho Bhidhiyate. The first sentence we will chant as we did last week. I will chant one or two words and repeat them along with me a second time. So I will say them first and then we'll do them together, bit by bit. Sadhana chatushtaya, sadhana chatushtaya, sampanna, sampanna, adhikarinam, adhikarinam, moksha sadhana, moksha sadhana, bhutam, bhutam, tattva viveka, tattva viveka, prakaram, prakaram, vakshyamaha, vakshyamaha. So last week we saw sadhana chaturshaya sampannadhikarinam moksha sadhana bhutam tattva viveka prakaram vakshyamaha. We will talk about vakshyamaha, the prakaram, the method of tattva viveka, of the discriminative analysis into tattva, into truth, into reality, which is bhutam, the moksha sadhanam, the means, the sadhana for freedom, moksha. For whom? For sadhana chatushtaya sampannadhikarinam, for the adhikaris, for those who are well prepared, qualified, who are sampanna, who are endowed with the sadhana chatushtaya, with the fourfold sadhanas or fourfold qualities. So now he will start off asking and answering questions. He starts off with the question, repeat after me, sadhana chatushtayam, sadhana chatushtayam, kim, kim. In English, most of our interrogative words, most of our words which ask questions, start with a wha sound, a wh, right? What, where, when, why, how, which is sort of close, it's still a ha sound. In Sanskrit, most of the interrogative words begin with a kakara, with a k. Kim, what? Ka, what, in a feminine form. Kaha, what, in a masculine form. Kutra, where, or kasmin. Katam, how. Kimartam, why. So here he says, sadhana chatushtayam kim. What is the sadhana chatushtaya you just mentioned? And then he will list the sadhana chatushtayam, and then he'll go on and ask a question about each one of those. So what we'll do is just look very briefly at the list of these four qualifications, and then we'll go into detail in the following sentences as he goes into more detail with these. Let's read these together here, as we did before. I will say them, and then we'll say them together. Nitya, nitya. Nitya nitya vastu vivekaha vastu vivekaha iha mutrartha iha mutrartha palabhoga palabhoga viragaha viragaha shamadishatka shamadishatka sampat Sampatihi, sampatihi, Dihi Mumukshutvan Jeti Mumukshutvan Jeti. So these four are Nitya Nitya Vastu Vivekaha, Iha Mutrartha Palabhoga Viragaha, Samadhi Shatka Sampatihi, and Mumukshutvam. Nitya Nitya Vastu Vivekaha. We've seen the word Vastu Vivekaha. We've seen the word Vivekaha. It means discriminative knowledge, discriminative inquiry into the Vastu, into the thing, into things, or the thing which is Nitya and Unnitya, which is time bound Anitya, and which is not time bound Nitya. The second one is Ihamutrartha Palabhoga Viragaha. Viragaha is a lack of interest, an objectivity, viragaha, a dispassion, if you will, towards the bhoga, enjoyments, of the karmapala, of the fruits, for objects here and in the hereafter. We'll go into all this in much detail in just a second. Shamadhi Shatka Sampatihi is a third qualification, and actually he's a bit sneaky because you only think that there's four of them, but here in the third qualification, there are six things. So that actually makes nine things because the third one has six. There's the sampattihi, the wealth, which is the shatka, the sixfold group of shama adi, of shama, etc. Shama, dhamma, uparama, etc. Cha iti, and lastly, mumukshutvam. Mumukshutvam is the state of being one who desires freedom. Let's look at these individually. Nitya nitya vastu vivekaha kaha. Nitya anitya, nitya anitya, vastu vivekaha, vastu vivekaha, kaha, kaha. Nitya vastu, nitya vastu, ekam brahma, tad vyatiriktam, sarvam, sarvam, anityam, anityam, ayameva, nitya nitya. Nitya, 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 vastu vivekaha, vastu vivekaha. Good. So the first two of these go together. You may be familiar with these. There's a lot of misconceptions about viveka and vairagya. Viveka and vairagya are meant to disentangle you from the trivial and give you a relative freedom and objectivity, provide you with a contemplative disposition, and to focus your attention as to where you spend your time, where do you look for your fullness. So we've seen the word viveka before. We saw it in the first sentence, which said, tatva viveka prakaram vakjamaha. We will talk about the tatva viveka prakaram, the means for the discriminative analysis into truth. You have two types of inquiry in Vedanta. One is called vichara, and one is called viveka. Vichara is when one thing is examined, when one thing is looked into. Viveka is when there's two things that need discernment, that need a discrimination between one and the other. When we saw in the yellow crystal, we had a clear crystal ball and a yellow flower behind it. So we wanted to discriminate, to do the discriminative analysis between the clear crystal and the yellow behind it. And that took some viveka. So here, what this viveka means is the discrimination between the nitya and the anitya. Nitya anitya vastu vivekaha. Kaha, what is? Kaha, what is the vivekaha regarding the vastu, the thing, which is nitya, not time-bound, and the thing which is anitya, the thing which is time-bound. The word nitya is often translated as eternal. And the problem with using that word is that we don't have anything in our experience that's eternal. So, you know, a teacher shouldn't use words for which we have no real meaning. We have no real reference, right? We can't say divine, eternal, supreme, because we don't know what divine really is. We don't know what eternal is. There's nothing in our experience that's eternal. And supreme, was that a singer? Was that a taco? I don't know. So to look at it a little more clearly, we tend to use the word time-bound and not time-bound. Something which is nitya is not time-bound, and something which is anitya is time-bound. In Sanskrit, the a prefix does very much what it does in English. It negates the word. So, for example, we have symmetrical and asymmetrical. So we add the a for it, and it negates it. Aerobic or anaerobic. So too in Sanskrit, a word that begins with a or un can often mean the opposite of what the rest of the word means. So here we have nitya, which means not time-bound, or eternal, if you will, and anitya, that which is not eternal, or which is time-bound. And vastu, vastu just means a thing. It's a very interesting word. We'll talk about this more in a minute. And here, what do we know of nitya vastu and anitya vastu? Really, all we know is anitya vastu. All we know is impermanent things, ephemeral things. That is what we often seek. What we search after are these things which are all time-bound. And so their capacity to give us any real lasting happiness is time-bound because they themselves are time-bound. So one example that's often used is Indian music. Indian music is the most exquisite and exciting music I've ever experienced. And, you know, the Hindustani and the Carnatic music, the North Indian, South Indian music are very different in some respects, but they have some common aspects. They're based on raga and thalam, or raga, rag and thal in the north, ragam or thalam in the south. Melody and rhythm, there is no harmony. And so in the melodic structure, in the raga, the musical interest, much of the musical interest comes from the tension that is created by the melody. And all melodies, in a sense, want to resolve into sa, into the tonic. Sa-re-ga-ma-pa-dha-ni-sa, sa-ni-da-pa-ma-ga-ri-sa, the upward scale and the descending scale. And in an alapana, or alap, they can do these beautiful gamakas, these beautiful melodic ornamentations where it's just very angelic. And at the very end of each major phrase, they'll always resolve into that sa, into that tonic, right? And so where do they know where that tonic is? The tonic meaning the first note, the sa, the C, if you will, in a C scale. It's because in the background, there's this tambura. And now it's often replaced by a shruti box or electronic tambura, where it sounds the pa-sa-sa-sa. Excuse my voice. I'm not a singer, but it's the 5-1-1-1, pa-sa-sa-sa. And that sa is the tonic. And often, it's only the musician that can hear it. But now with the amplification, everybody can hear it. And the joy of the music is how the melody, how the main melodic instrumentalist or vocalist plays around that tonic and uses the raga and the ascending and descending scale and the gamakas, the ornamentation, and the melody to create this tension and to create this beauty, all of which depends on fundamentally that sa, that tonic. There's that constant, you're constantly hearing that sa, that tonic, and all melody is in relation to that. All melody is based on that tonic. All melody is based on that sa. So why am I talking about this? Because that tambura, that shruti is called, the shruti in the background never changes. It's constant. And that is, I want, I want. The melody of what we produce, the melody over what we seek, We can seek the re, ga, ma, pa, da, ni, sa. We can seek all these things. We can seek all these ornamentations. We can seek all these things in our lives to bring us happiness. And at the very end, when all that chatter stops, when the melody stops, when the singer takes a breath, what do we hear? I want. There's a constant drone. A constant drone of I want, and that I want manifests as this music of our lives of I seek this. The very basis of all of our desires resolves into this tonic, into this saw, into this drone of I want. And we saw that that is based on a limited self-concept, a mistaken identity of who we are as being a limited wanting person. But that want is always there. I want this. I want artha. I want kama. I want dharma. We talked about a lot of this in the introduction. I want security because I feel insecure. Artha. I want wealth. I want kama. I want enjoyments because I seek distraction. I seek novelty. I seek pleasure. To try to soothe this ache that I have, this I want. I'm not what I want to be. I'm not the pleased person. And these things that we seek are temporary balm for this wound that we have, this I want, that's never extinguished. That drone just keeps going on and on and on and on and on. Until finally we realize through Purushartha Viveka, through Purushartha Nishchaya. Purushartha Nishchaya is the ascertainment, the Nishchaya that what we really seek in every Purushartha, when we seek anything in the world, any pleasure, any even heaven or security, is I seek the pleased person. I seek the secure person. I seek the person who's not time bound. I'm really seeking moksha. Every pursuit is really seen as seeking moksha. It all resolves into this tonic, into the realization that what's underlying all of our desires, just as what underlies all of the melody, is this constant drone, this fundamental, and this fundamental is the fundamental human problem that I lack, I am wanting, I am less than I want to be, which is based on the ignorance of the truth of who I am. So this anitya vastu, this impermanent, ephemeral world, things, that's one thing. And so the other thing might be nitya vastu, something which is not time bound. Do we actually know something which is not time bound? We don't know anything in our experience that is not time bound. We have indirect knowledge, apatata jnanam. You know, our elders tell us, we have paperback knowledge, we have an inkling that there's something more. And the Shastra tells us, you know, if you've studied your Veda, it says there is something, and that's called Brahman, and that is nitya, that is not time-bound. So, but at this point, we're just looking at the qualifications for this inquiry. You know, a jnani, one who actually knows the truth, actually sees nitya and anitya, and knows what they are, the time-bound and the not time-bound, and actually understands the way things are. We talked about Paricha lokan karma chitan brahmano nirveda mayat nastikrita kritena. We saw that in the Upanishad it says that examining our experience, we see that nothing truly valuable is created in time by effort. Nastikrita kritena, kritena by action, na asti akritaha, the uncreated thing, the thing which is not time bound. The thing which is really the true value, because that is what we seek in all of our pursuits, this nitya vastu, this timeless thing, literally, nitya vastu means the time-free thing, which is what we seek in every experience of joy. That is not a created thing. It's not a karmapala. Krita. Krita means an action. Kritena, by action. Nastya krita kritena. Someone, a brahmana, a intelligent person, realizes that nothing substantial, nothing really worth spending a whole lot of time in, putting my heart into, in a sense of counting on, fulfilling myself as a person, to fill this hole in my soul, nothing that is created will do that, because anything as created is time-bound, is anitya. So we distinguish between what's nitya and what's anitya, and our value system changes because we become mumukshus. We become someone who's interested in moksha. We become interested in that drone. What's the cause of that drone? I want. This is my imitation of a tambora. I want. Sorry. I'm not a singer. But that's what we look for. We look for the underlying cause. First, identify this need. I want. I'm less. And once we see that, we want to put that fire out. We want to see what's the root cause of that. And so all of our pursuits resolve into moksha. And so we become mumukshus. Because what do we want? Do we want crutches, or do we want to be independent? Independence is moksha. Moksha is freedom, independence from this life of samsara, from this constant striving, this constant need to become. Really, you know, I don't need to become a satisfied person. I need to discover that satisfied person in myself. And so when we have that viveka, our values shift and our priorities shift. And then we see that there really is a lack of a connection between what I do and what I want. What I do is seek temporary solutions, and what I want is a permanent solution. What I seek is anitya in my day-to-day experience, but what I really seek is nitya. What I really seek is something which will permanently solve this problem and stop me from constantly having to try to become something. So this viveka between the nitya and anitya vastu, between something which might be eternal and something which might be ephemeral, permanent and impermanent, that is the first qualification. And like I said, we have this apatataha jnanam. We have this sense there that there's something more. Puja Swamiji talks about paperback knowledge. We read some Upanishads, we get some inspiration from somebody. Here the author says, nitya vastu ekam brahma. He says, nitya, he asks the questions, right? Nitya, nitya vastu vivekaha kaha. What is kaha, the vivekaha, between the nitya vastu and the anitya vastu? And his answer is, nitya vastu ekam brahma, tad vyatiriktam sarvam anityam. Nitya vastu ekam brahma. He says that the nitya vastu, it's amazing some of these words that the Shastra has, the Upanishad has. Vastu just means a thing. Vastu just means a thing. It's the thing. Right? In English, we say, oh, there's all these things, but the thing is, there's only one thing. And it's ekam, it's one. It's advayam, it's non-dual. So why do we say there's only one thing? We can't jump ahead too far, but really there's only one thing of value, and there's only one thing that enjoys an independent existence. Everything else in our experience, everything else enjoys a dependent existence. Just like I said last week, the table enjoys a dependent reality on the wood. The chair is just a nama rupa. A chair is just, I will go into this much further a little way down the road, but a chair is just a convenient construct upon which we can sit, right? Really all there is wood. And the chair is just a name and form. It's just a construct that has a dependent reality. We can't say that the chair doesn't exist. It's not an illusion. We can interact with it on the level that it's meant to be interacted with. But it enjoys a dependent reality. And when we'll look at this much deeper, but everything enjoys a dependent reality called mithya, except for one thing. Ekam vastu, the thing which is one, and it's called Brahma. So the Shastra gives a word for it, Brahma. Brahma is a beautiful word. It comes from the dhatu, the verbal root brh, which means vriddhi, which means to grow. Something that grows and grows and grows. It really imply the meaning of active growing, but something that is big, something which is bigness. And you say, well, what does bigness mean? What does bigness mean? How big is big? It's funny because we often think that an adjective modifies a noun. We have a red car. Red is the adjective. Car is the substantive, is the noun. The adjective modifies the noun. It's a red car. It's not a blue car. It's not a yellow car. It's a red car. Look at this. It's a big mosquito. This is Swamiji. You know, I steal everything from Pooja Swamiji. None of this is my own. He says, it's a big mosquito. What is big there? Just think of bigness. What is big? A big mosquito, what, that big maybe? Is that how big mosquitoes get? It's a big mountain. Now, is the bigness of the mosquito in any way in the same ballpark, as we say, as the bigness of the mountain? No. So in effect, mosquito, the word mosquito modifies our notion of bigness because it constrains it to mosquito size. And the mountain constrains our notion of bigness because it's that bigness that the mountain enjoys is mountain bigness. So imagine taking that big, that adjective big, and removing the substantive completely. So we're not talking about a mosquito bigness. We're not talking about a mountain bigness. We're just talking about bigness unqualified by any particular thing. It's that concept, unlimited bigness. Bigness, it's everything. It's everything. That's Brahman. That's why they have the word Brahman. It's the biggest thing that is because there is nothing that can constrain it because we're not talking about a mosquito or a mountain. We're talking about everything that is. So we know that there's something called Brahman. We know that the Upanishad says, Brahmavid apnoti param. Brahmavid, the one who knows Brahman, param apnoti, gains that which is limitless. So by knowing this Brahman, we gain something that is limitless. And that's what we really seek in every pursuit. We seek the limitless. And therefore, viveka is not just that the purusharthas all resolve into moksha, into mumukshutvam, into the desire for freedom, but further viveka is that mumukshutvam, that desire for moksha, resolves into jignasa, into the desire for knowledge, into this desire for the nitya vastu, the one thing, the vastu, which is nitya, not time-bound, which is Brahman, which is the limitless big, which is ekam, which is one, which is non-dual. And we have an inkling of that, right? We have a shraddha, we have some trust in the shastra, we have people whom we trust who say that this is valid knowledge. We have a sense in our moment of happiness, we sense the limitlessness of our soul, if you want to wax a bit poetic, you know? We don't really know what that is. We may have had some experiences, we may have had some mystical experiences, or we may have had some inkling that there's more. And that moreness is potential of limitlessness. And that's what we know. We don't really know what it is, but we know it's worth pursuing. And that's what this nitya nitya vastu viveka is. Until we really see what that nitya vastu is, until we really see what that non-time bound thing is, and then we'll see that nitya nitya vastu viveka in a whole different light. Because we'll see the relationship between what is nitya and anitya. What's that relationship between those two vastus? Apparently there's two things, right? There's a nitya vastu and an anitya vastu. There's a thing, a vastu, which is not time-bound, and a thing and a bunch of things which are time-bound. So we'll look at that a little further down the road. But the Brahman is said to be the thing from which all this comes, by which all this is sustained, and into which all this resolves. That's worth looking into, right? And it's a knowledge of which is said to be the solution to this underlying drone of desire, of neediness, this constant drone that I need. And we can finally pluck the last string on the tambora and resolve into that silence of purnatvam, of that completeness, through jignasa, through the satisfaction of the desire to know this nitya vastu. That is nitya nitya vastu vivekaha. It says that nitya vastu ekam brahma, this one non-time-bound thing, is ekam brahma, is that one Brahman. The author also says, tad vyatiriktam sarvam anityam. Sarvam, everything which is tad vyatiriktam, which is vyatiriktam, which is different from that. Tat means that. Sarvam means everything. Anityam is anityam, is time-bound. Everything other than that Brahman is time-bound. And therefore, our value structure is such, we're not seeking the ephemeral, we're seeking the non-ephemeral. We're seeking the one substantive. If my tongue could work, I would say, we're seeking the thing, the one thing, the vastu. And if you look at the perishable nature of everything that's around us, it's a really interesting vision just to go through your day and just see that everything here has a beginning and an end. I think I've mentioned this before. Shankaracharya's guru's guru in his Karika on the Mandukya Upanishad says, Adau ante cha yanasti vartamane tattata. Adau ante, that which has a prior and posterior non-existence. That which didn't exist before at some time, and that which won't exist in the future, adau ante, at the beginning, ante and at the end, adau ante cha yat na asti, that which does not exist before and henceforth, vartamane tattata, should be considered to be basically the same now. How much reality does something have? If it didn't exist in the past and won't exist in the future, how valuable is it now? It's a questionable value when you're looking for something that is nitya, which is eternal. Furthermore, he goes on and says, I am eva nitya nitya vastu vivekaha. He just sums it up here. He says, this indeed, I am eva indeed, is the discriminative understanding between the nitya vastu and the anitya vastu. Okay? What is the result of this viveka? He goes on to say, Viragaha kaha, viragaha kaha, iha swarga, bhogeshu, bhogeshu, iccha, iccha, rahityam, rahityam. Previously, he said, Iha amutrartha palabhoga viragaha. And now he asks the question, okay, so give us more information about what this viragaha is. Raga, so viragaha kaha, kaha. What is viragaha? Might be more familiar with the term vairagyam. Ragaha means a longing, a desire. We think of raga and dvesha, they always come in pairs, right? The likes and dislikes, but they're not just likes and dislikes, they're binding likes and dislikes. It's a longing for something to be a certain way. It's a longing for something. It's a requirement for me to be happy. And a viragaha is the absence of that. You take what's called a tadhita in Sanskrit, you derive an abstract noun from that, and the first syllable takes the vriddhi, vairagya, and you add ya at the end, you get dispassion. Raga can mean passion, vairagyam can mean dispassion. And it's not the best word for it. Really what it is an objectivity. What it isn't is this, and I don't know where this story came from, but apparently there's a story of a saint, and one of his students wanted to test him. And so they put a piece of gold under his bed, and apparently he had a very difficult time sleeping. And to this devotee, that proved that this saint had vairagya, had this dispassion, because the presence of gold caused him a problem, made him sleep not very soundly. That's not really vairagya. Vairagya is an objectivity. Gold is gold. Within the sphere, within the domain of metals, it's a relatively rare metal, and so within the domain of economics, it's a valuable commodity, and it has a certain objective value. But it only has value in its own domain, in its economic domain. Gold cannot solve the fundamental human problem. So even though I need to deal with gold or gold substitutes, dollar bills or rupees or whatever, I have an objectivity to it. I know what gold can accomplish and I know what it can't accomplish. I know that my insecurity, that hole in my heart that says I need to be secure, will never be filled by any amount of gold, by any amount of dollars, any amount of rupees. It just won't be. That search for artha, that search for security, that I often attribute money having the capacity to fill, that what's called shobhanadhyasa. Shobhana Dhyasa is very interesting. Be a little sidetrack here. There's two types of dhyasa, superimposition. There's one wherein something is projected on something else, right? So I'm walking down the road and I project a thief on the tree, like we've been talking about. That's a dhyasa. Shobhana Dhyasa is the capacity for us to attribute a value to something that doesn't have that value. And so we often attribute the latest shiny thing. Here's the latest one, the Apple Watch. The Apple Watch will make me happy. Or the Apple 6 iPhone Plus. The iPhone 6 Plus. It just came out. It's the latest. It's the greatest. It's the most shiny phone out there. It will make me happy. That's Shobhana Dhyasa. A phone can make phone calls or texts or run apps or whatever you need it to do. But really, in the end, it will become last year's model, and it will just be a phone, and it will have problems, and it will fall on the ground, and it will break, and it will no longer be shiny and new. We attribute the capacity for something ephemeral, temporary, to give us our feeling of satisfaction, to invoke the pleased person. That's Shobhana Dhyasa, which they can only temporarily invoke the pleased person, but it cannot really show me that I am that pleased person. So, iha, here, amutra, or swarga, he glosses amutra there, means swarga. So either in this life or in the next life, any arthapala bhoga, in respect to bhoga, in respect to any enjoyments of here or the hereafter, even in heaven, because in this tradition, there is the vision of heaven being a karmapala, right? You do good works and you get your just rewards, but your good works are limited, and then your just rewards are limited, and you find yourself back here, a limited person. So even the experience of heaven is time-bound because it was created by action, and therefore it's time-bound. So iha, here in this world, swarga, in heaven, bhogeshu, in regard to enjoyments, there's icha rahityam, the absence of desire, the absence of a longing for enjoyments here and in the hereafter, because we don't give undue value to things. We're not disturbed by the presence of gold. We can handle money. We just don't see it as the end game. So really what it is, it's an internalization of viveka. If we really see the value that things have, we can live very objectively. Vairagya is best translated as objectivity. It's not a disdain for things. It's not like we disdain the world or upset by the world. Things in the world have its place, but we don't give it undue value. And one example of vairagya is, how much attraction does a bald man have walking down the shampoo aisle in a store? Is he terribly concerned? Is a bald man terribly concerned with the latest and greatest versions of Head and Shoulders or the latest and greatest hair conditioner or hair coloring? He has no interest whatsoever. It's not like he disdains those things. It's not like he's bothered by the presence of shampoo. It just is not on his radar. It has no meaning for him. He has no interest in it. He's objective towards it. He doesn't need it in his life. He doesn't need it out of his life. That's all. And he's free. He has no hair. You're free from any raga and dvesha regarding hair products. Some people spend hundreds of dollars a year or more maybe on their hair, coloring it and operations to get more of it. And that's a whole different conversation. Vairagya is born of viveka and it grows over time. When I was 5 years old, let's say, like I said, I steal all my best material from Swamiji. When I was 5 years old, my parents took me to a fair, the Del Mar County Fair, and bought me a helium balloon, a bright red helium balloon. And I was very happy. And for a number of minutes, I was very happy because I had this bright red floating shiny balloon with some cartoon character on it. And half an hour after I had it, the string slipped from my hand and it was off. It's a very sad story. And I started crying, let's say. Right? My happiness was so intertwined with that beautiful red balloon that was floating over my head. Now, fast forward 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years later, what's my relationship with that red balloon? Let's say someone takes me to the fair and buys me a red balloon. What's my relationship with that balloon? I can have that balloon. I cannot have that balloon. That balloon slips from my hand. That helium balloon flies up. I look at it and smile and go, wow, look, there it goes. There it is. This vairagya grows over time. Let's say as a 40-year-old man, I start crying when that balloon slips from my hand. I have some growing to do. I have some emotional growth to do. And that's when balloon tapas becomes interesting. We talked about tapas before. We talked about spiritual austerities. Tapas is an austerity, like standing on one leg in the river Ganga for days on end, or sitting in front of a fire in the hot sun, you know, things that really stress you. They can be much gentler forms of tapas, austerities, right? We talked about Vak tapas. It's a spiritual discipline of making sure that your speech is truthful, is beneficial, and is sweet. So if I have this odd relationship with red balloons as a 40-year-old man, it might be very interesting for me to go buy a half a dozen red balloons and just practice letting them go until I have no emotional response to the presence or the absence of a red balloon. And then my vairagya is complete, because I can think, my happiness is not dependent on this red balloon. This red balloon, even if I were not to let it go, will eventually wither and just become a red piece of latex on the ground. I can see that. And if I see that again and again, and in a sense, you can practice this. You can practice this by letting the red balloon go. And that's what some tapas is. If we're attached to food, it's interesting to fast. If we're attached to sleep, meaning if I find my fullness, think my fullness is dependent on sleeping in, then I might try getting up early. It's just an interesting experiment, and that tapas is just to sort of shake things up a little bit so that you see, I can be happy even if I just eat rice and dal for 3 days. But that doesn't mean that I need to push it away. It doesn't mean that I disdain nicely seasoned curry. I don't disdain that, and I accept it when it's not there. I don't have a need, like a six-year-old needs that red balloon. It's an objectivity. It's a maturity. It's emotional maturity. And it's an assimilation of the viveka, because your life can become very simple. And it's a growing process. Your life can be very simple when you see that this nor this nor this nor this nor this is really what I'm looking for. This person can be as they are. I don't need this person to be a specific way, because their presence or absence in my life, you know, or the way they behave really don't determine my self-worth, especially if you see yourself through the vision, through the eyes of the rishis. If you have the arshadrishti, if you have the vision of the rishis, there's great freedom in that. There's the ultimate freedom, because that's knowledge of this nitya vastu. The best translation for vairagya is really objectivity. And since vairagya is, in a sense, a manifestation and assimilation of viveka, the more viveka you have, the more clearly you differentiate between what is valuable and what is not valuable, what is nitya and what is anitya. The more vairagya you naturally have, the more emotionally mature you become, the more you have this freedom to let things be as they are. And the more you have the objectivity, the more subtle your viveka becomes, your discernment of really what is important and what is true, and what is ephemeral, and what is not so important. If you have some vairagya, then everything you do, every role you play, every action that you're called upon by the world to perform is yoga. Everything becomes sadhana. You are a sadhaka. You are one whose primary objective is to cut through and pursue knowledge of truth. And you use every experience you get to grow emotionally, to practice, in a sense, your viveka and vairagya, and everything becomes karma yoga. So that is viveka and vairagya. Iha amutrartha palabhoga viragaha, iha swarga bhogeshu icha rahityam, the absence of a longing, of a binding desire, of icha, towards enjoyments here and hereafter. You know, none of us have these in absolute measure, and you'll never have these in absolute measure. But in a relative measure, the more you have these, the clearer the vision of the teaching will become. And the clearer the vision of the teaching, the clearer your knowledge, the more these things grow. So there's not only a mutual benefit between viveka and vairagya, there's a mutual benefit between the deepening of your study and these qualities, and vice versa. The third element of the fourfold qualifications for an adhikari, for one who is qualified for this study, is shama adi shatka sampattihi. So let's read that. Shama adi shatka sampattihi. Sampattihi ka. Let's read the next sentence. Shamaha. I'll break the sandhi so we can see each of these words. Shamaha. Damaha. Uparamaha. Titiksha. Shraddha, samadhanam, cheti. And that is cha iti. Iti is an interesting word. It just puts everything behind it in quotes. So the question he asks is, shama adi shatka sampattihi ka? What is ka? Now this is a strilinga, this is a feminine, because sampattihi is feminine. So ka, before we saw kaha, we saw kim, and now we're saying ka. Ka sampattihi. What is this sampattihi? Sampattihi means this wealth. What is this wealth? Shatka sampattihi, this sixfold wealth. Shat means six, right? Shanmukha is Subramanyam. Shanmukha. Sampattihi, what is this sixfold wealth whose beginning, whose adi is shama? So this is a very common Sanskrit construct where you say shamadi. It means that group of things whose adi, whose beginning is shama. So we translate it as etc. Shamadi, shama, etc. What is this sixfold wealth which begins with shama? And then he goes on to list them, and then he'll go on into detail for each of them. So he says one is shama, one is dhamma, uparamaha, titiksha, shraddha, samadhanam cha. And I think these are best left untranslated right now. We will be taking, at the beginning of the next class, the shama and dhamma. And we'll actually take these in the reverse order because it makes more sense to unfold that way. And we'll probably get through all these next week. So let's sit quietly for just a minute or two. Om ॐ स्वस्ति प्रजाभ्यः परिपालयन्ताम् न्यायेन मार्गेण महीं महिषाः को ब्राह्मणेभ्यः शुभमस्तु नित्यम् लोकाः समस्ता सुखिनो भवन्तु काले वर्षति पर्जन्यः पृथिवी सस्यशालिनी एषो यक्षोपरहितः ब्राह्मणाः सन्तु निर्भयाः ॐ सर्वे भवन्तु सुखिनः सर्वे सन्तु निरामयाः सर्वे भद्राणि पश्यन्तु मा कश्चित् दुःखभाग् भवेत् असतो मा सद्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मा अमृतङ्गमय ॐ पूर्णमदः पूर्णमिदं पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्यते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरिः ॐ श्रीगुरुभ्यो नमः हरिः ॐ तत्सत् सर्वमीश्वरार्पणमस्तु ॐ Any questions? We should be able to get through next week. We should be able to get through Samadhi and Mumukshutvam. And then there's a whole new section of the book that starts, which goes into the Atmavichara proper, which is the analysis, the inquiry into the nature of the individual. And that's kind of really where the rubber starts hitting the road, if you will. Not that this hasn't been Vedanta, but really, Vedanta is knowledge of oneself, and that's the process to understand the truth of oneself.
You might say that maybe I didn't understand anything, but I'm still not clear. How do you recognize or know the nitya thing, nitya vastu? How do you know that?
Well, right now, we just have an inkling. We only have indirect knowledge, right? We have, it's a funny situation, like in the 10th man story. It's as if the 10th man has been promised. He says, there is a 10th man, but I don't know that it's me yet.
Right.
So that's the situation we're in. We don't know that yet because as a qualification for study, you can't assume that someone who hasn't studied yet knows the subject matter. So that's why we take nitya anitya vastu vivekaha as purushartha nishchaya, as the clear understanding of what it is we're seeking. We're really seeking moksha. And we have what's called apatataha jnanam, a happenstantial knowledge. Swamiji calls it a paperback knowledge. We have either by studying the Veda, by our own swadhyaya, by our own study, by a traveling swami who's come to town, by a book that we've read, you know, by a teacher that we had, by my parents, you know, having the Bhagavad Gita in their puja room, by something we saw on YouTube, by some experience we may have had, there's something that tells us that there is a nitya vastu. And that's what the rest of this teaching is. That's what the rest of this book is to discern really what that nitya vastu is, really what Brahman is. That's what this whole teaching will be. That's what the rest of this text will unfold. So right now it's just a provisional knowledge of what's nitya. There's a shraddha, there's a faith, there's a trust in the teacher and the teaching and the shastra. Mm-hmm. And there's a trust that when, as the 10th man said, this person says the 10th man does exist and will be shown to me, but I don't know who that is yet. Mm-hmm. So that's the position that we're in right now with this nitya vastu.
Well, hang in there.
Yeah. And it's, as I said last week, it's a very subtle discernment because it is the only vastu. It's the ekam brahma vastu. It's the one thing that really is the substantive. It's just that we see so many things in our experience. Nothing in our experience is away from that ekam brahma, from that one brahman. It's just that we don't see it. We haven't done the viveka. We haven't discerned what is nitya and what is anitya. And once we really see clearly what that is, well, first, the next part of this book will go into the atma vichara. What is the true nature of the self? And we mistake ourselves to be so many things. We mistake ourselves to be a body or mind, etc. And we'll, you know, if handled correctly, we'll be able to see our relationship with these things that we take ourselves to be.
Namaste, Dakshaji. It's Hema here.
Hey, Hema. Yes. Thank you.
So with respect to the same question, is it that, you know, over time, emotional maturity, that also grows, that grows over time.
Yes.
So similarly, the clarity of the knowledge itself also gains clarity over time. It's not a one-time, you know, this is, I've recognized what is nitya vastu, but it is like it also grows over time. Is that right?
That's our experience, is that it deepens over time. We get glimpses as we teach, right? I mean, you are immediately available for your complete understanding right now, but it takes exposure to the pramana. It takes exposure to see that again and again and again. And each time you see it, you go, oh, I see that. Wow, I had never seen that before. And then you may listen to the same class again a year later, and you go, and you say, wow, I didn't see that before. Now I see this even more clearly. So really what's happening is that the vagueness is going away. You know, the error may be resolved once you see this, but then it tends to creep back in. You know, that's the purpose of mananam and nididhyasana. So we expose ourselves to the teaching. It's not only that this makes sense in an abstract sense. This is not a theoretical knowledge. This is a direct knowledge of myself because I'm here to be recognized. But then we think, oh, but how can that possibly be? I thought I was this. We have these habits. We've been these individuals, these limited wanting individuals for so long, since the beginning of time, you know, that we have these habitual habits, and we have what's called viparita bhavana. Even once you see this truth, you may have a sense of something that's contrary to what you know. You know that you're this free, conscious, satchit ananda, this being, this complete being, and yet you behave as if you're not. And so that's what the purpose of nididhyasana is, to address that habitual sense of being a limited being. But as this viveka grows, as this shama grows, etc., as this vairagya grows, as this mumukshutvam grows, that knowledge becomes deeper and richer and clearer until there's what's called jnana nishtha. Nishtha means abiding in this knowledge. It's where you never take yourself to be less than you are, because you're really retraining this ahankara. This ahankara, this ahankara is often translated as the ego, right? I'm such and such, like egoism. But it's better translated as this I notion. It literally means, aham means I, kara means maker, this I maker. And it's the thing that makes us a limited individual. And it really, yeah, its core is ignorance. There's a little voice inside. Whenever I say I, whom do I point to when I say I? Who is really the object of the first person singular pronoun I? If it's Parabrahma, if it's limitless Brahman, like we just talked about, the biggest thing, bigger than the notion of big, then you see yourself truly. But often this ahankara says, I am this, I am this, I am this, I am small, I am wanting, I am short, I am fat, I am tall, I am stupid, I am rich, I am poor. I am, I am, I am. And it's really this little imp of a thought based on ignorance that keeps pointing out to me how small and limitless I am. And that's a habitual process of the mind that completely keeps mistaking myself to be less than I am. Now, it cannot resolve, that ahankara cannot resolve into Brahman, that sense of I cannot resolve into limitlessness, unless I know that I am limitless. So first I have to know what I am not. I have to line these nine boys up and say, neti, 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 I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm not this. And then you can see the truth of what you are. Ah, aham brahmasmi, right? That's a Mahavakya. I am Brahman. I see that. And then you leave the class, and this ahankara comes in and says, I am now this individual walking down the road. And you go, oh, I'm this individual. I'm hungry. I'm subject to sukha. I'm subject to dukkha. I'm subject to this. I'm the small individual now. So it's insidious. Ahankara is insidious. And even though the knowledge is there, you don't gain nishtha. You don't gain an abiding knowledge immediately unless you are the uttama adhikari, the most qualified student. If you are a Ramana Maharshi and you have this viveka vragya shatva sampattihi and mumukshutvam, if that's just the nature of who you are due to all these past lives of sadhana or just your innate disposition for whatever reason, if you're that qualified student, there is no doubt, there is no vagueness, there is no error. It's that this ahankara resolves in Brahman and says, I am Brahman, I am the truth, I am limitless. And this little tiny ahankara never comes back and limits you. Now you could have, it's called a badhita ahankara. Badhita means negated, right? You still think, you still have the thinking process of, oh, I'm hungry now. But that I is just, it's just a functional I. When you say I'm hungry, really what you're saying is I'm the body or I'm the prana, right? I'm the prana and I am hungry. Now you can really believe yourself to be I based on ignorance of who you really are, or you can just say, you know, oh, I'm hungry. But really what you know yourself to be no different than Brahman, but Brahman never gets hungry. And so there's no need to say. In fact, there are some spiritual teachers who unfortunately say things like, oh, this body is hungry, this body is walking. You know, that's kind of a spiritual elitism. Oh, I'm so spiritual that I can talk about myself in the third person. Daksha is hungry. Daksha is walking down the road. Just if anybody ever hears me saying that, just slap me upside the head, because that's just silly. So you can have this functional ahankara, but you just know. It's like looking at the sunset. You can say, oh, the sun is setting into the ocean. But that's badhita. That's negated. You don't think that the sun is really setting into the ocean. You know that it's just the earth rotating, and it'll come up again in the morning. The tragedy of that sun being extinguished in the ocean, that's all dismissed based on your knowledge of astronomy, you know, what's really happening there. So too with the knowledge of oneself, the tragedy of one being a wanting, limited, hurting individual is negated. So you can enjoy living a limited life, but you never take yourself to be this limited person. And you can enjoy whatever prarabdha comes to you, whatever karma comes to you, whatever fate, whatever Ishvara happens to present to you in any given moment. You say, oh, now I can do this. Oh, now this needs to be done. Oh, now I need to chop wood. Now I need to carry water. Now I need to sweep the floor. Now I need to, you know, be a congressman. Now I need to play the role of a mother or a sister or a daughter or, you know, of a spouse. You can fill those roles completely, because whatever presents itself in my life is not a determining factor of my purnatvam, of my completeness, because I, this ahankara, this aham, this I thought, always truly resolves into my limitless nature. And that nishtha, that steadiness, that abiding in that knowledge takes time for most of us, because we are not uttama adhikaris. We are not people who have complete viveka vairagya. The world catches us. We get angry. We think that our happiness is at stake in the world, right? We don't have a contemplative mind. We're bothered by the least little thing. We don't have shama, we don't have dhamma, which we'll talk about next week. And our viveka is not clear, and therefore our vairagya is wanting. So does that help?
That's very helpful, Acharya. Yeah, that's like, one is like sort of identification, the wrong notions, the I, as you said, the hankara, the I, is very, very binding. Whereas otherwise it's just functional, not binding. You can take on these different roles, activities, actions, and
yeah, and you don't have anything really at stake. Really, your purnatvam, your completeness, is not at stake by whatever role you happen to be playing. and that, and being free in any situation, it does take time, right? It does take some, you know, knowledge itself doesn't take time. Knowledge itself is not a function of an action, but abiding in this knowledge, it takes choice. It takes choice to expose yourself to the pramana. It takes choice to exercise viveka, to see again and again what I truly am and where my priorities are. And I can still be doing the things that I need to be doing, but do I approach my life as a desperate man on a sinking ship, struggling for straws of happiness? Or do I approach it as my sadhana, as a yogi, as someone who uses every experience for maturity and viveka so that I can gain that abiding knowledge?
Is non-judgmental watching of the mind an important part of sadhana, an important part of understanding the difference between nitya and anitya? Is this something that can be practiced by people like us?
Now, what was the first part? The non-judging watching of the mind?
When you are doing something, or when you're talking to somebody, or when you're feeling something, if you're able to step back and watch your mind and say, okay, what is it that I was thinking when I did this or said this or got concerned about this? And then you step back and say, okay, this is, I think I should not have probably overreacted to something that I did, or can I correct myself on that front? I think I'd be more happy if I do that. I mean, is this kind of a self, non-judgmental understanding of the mind important in these kinds of, in the sadhana?
Yes. No, that was very well said. There's two ways you can think about, you know, because when you said watching the mind, now we'll talk about this when we do the Atmavichara, and there's this sakshitvam. At one stage, if you will, from one perspective, you are the witness of your mind. But that's not the whole story. But to abide in a place wherein you can see the processes of your mind and where you get hooked, that's very valuable. What you're talking about also is a reflective nature, looking at a past experience, saying, I just had this emotional reaction, I just had this response. What's the cause of that reaction? Where do I feel that I'm at stake that causes me to feel insecure, to respond with anger? You know, what are my childhood issues that I need to work on? All that stuff. Yes, that's all very important for burning these seeds, for vairagya to grow, for viveka. That's really viveka. So there's this discrimination between atma and anatma, which we'll get to in a class or two. And then there's that growing emotional maturity, which I think you were talking about, is just being reflective on how I behave. And the key word which you said there, which I was very happy you said, was non-judgmental, because it's so easy for us to say, I'm supposed to be a sadhaka. I'm supposed to be someone who has some spiritual bent, and I just blew up and yelled at somebody. I am a horrible person. And if you hear that I am is me, but I am not a horrible person. You know, we're fallible. We weren't raised perfectly, and we have these tendencies. So I think it was well said when you said that, if it's non-judgmental, then you're really bringing an objectivity. And that's really what vairagya is, that objectivity towards the own phenomenon in your heart and in your mind. And you're applying that attentiveness, you know, that attention and that attentiveness to help break these patterns, these habitual patterns of behavior that I don't want. And we'll talk about this in Shama and Dhamma. That's really, Shama and Dhamma, the next two things we're going to talk about that directly, about our response, our reactiveness, and whether we have a choice to respond or not in the midst of a reaction. So, yeah, that was well said.
Can I ask just one little question?
Yes, please.
I don't know if anybody else has a question. You know, the word ahankar, all my life I've understood it to mean arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That is the Hindi word, ahankar.
Yeah.
And for me to, the irony to me is that if I say I am a little person, I'm this, that is ahankar. Whereas to say I'm Brahma is not ahankar, it's totally contradictory. How can I say I'm Brahma? How can I say I'm God? I'm not that. You know, it goes against my sense of humility. And who am I to say I'm Brahma?
Mm-hmm.
That to me is ahankar, to say I'm Brahma, than to say I'm this ordinary, humble, small, fat person or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm having a little bit of, you know, to deal with that.
Yeah, so ahankar, I haven't introduced it well. We haven't actually introduced it yet.
Okay.
It's really the antakarana, the inner instrument, the mind, is broken up into four different functions: buddhi, manas, ahankara, and chittam. And we'll talk about really what those are. So ahankara, I was using it in sort of a technical sense. Manitvam, dambitvam, taking pride in qualities you don't have, or taking pride in qualities that you do have, that's arrogance. But to your question about how can I, this little person, isn't that audacious of me?
Exactly.
To say that I am God?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's really this whole teaching is, we look at three things: the nature of the self, the nature of the world, the nature of God, and the relationship between those three.
Mm-hmm.
So this is jumping way ahead, but the basic tension in any equation is the apparent disparity between the two sides of the equation.
Right.
So I can say 4 plus 5 equals 3 squared.
Right.
Right? And you say, how could that be? Because on one side I have two numbers. Mm-hmm. On the other side I have one number. On one side I have an arithmetic operator, you know, a plus sign, and the other one, there doesn't seem to be anything there. So how can I say that 4 plus 5 equals 3 squared?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tension that needs to be resolved.
Mm-hmm.
And that equation is Vedanta. That equation, Tattvam Asi is the equation. You are Ishvara. And so because we haven't looked at it yet, we don't really know who we are, there's this natural tension. And so this teaching is to resolve each side of that equation and see if the Shastra is lying or not. See the relationship. See what that equal sign really means. And if the Shastra says, you are that, then maybe we need to gently release some notions of who we are. Maybe we need to better understand who we are. And when you understand that, it's not the individual who takes pride in being. No individual is uniquely Ishvara, right? Another way to look at it yet. When you have the clarity of vision to say, I am Ishvara, I am Bhagavan, you see everyone else as being equally Bhagavan. There's no arrogance there. There's a surrender. There's a humility, because there's nothing here but Bhagavan. There's nothing here but Ishvara. But you have to resolve both sides of the tension between both sides of that equation, to see that and to say that.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. Well, thank you. It's getting late. Thank you all for coming. I hope to see you all next week.
Namaste. Okay. Thank you.